This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Lawmakers at the state capitol have been considering two intertwined issues about law enforcement that we'll be talking about today. Both of these issues have sadly been dragged back to the top of the public's consciousness after a video surfaced of a white North Charleston, South Carolina police officer shooting a black man in the back and killing him after a traffic stop. A little later, we'll listen back to a conversation we had in New Haven about police transparency and arrest records in Connecticut, featuring New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman and Chief State's Attorney Kevin Kane. But first, a new report from Central Connecticut State University has found racial and ethnic disparities in traffic stops by Connecticut police departments.
I think the goal of all of this is not to indict a town or condemn a police department. The goal of it is to address what is a very real concern on the part of many people in the state, and that is that there is racially biased policing taking place.
That was Mike Lawler, State Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning, speaking at a hearing on Tuesday. We'll take a closer look at this report and what it tells us about racial profiling and traffic stops in our state. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're joined in studio by Ken Barone, Research and Policy Specialist for the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy at CCSU. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Earl Bloodworth is here. He's Information Officer for the state's African American Affairs Commission. Earl, welcome.
Thank you.
The first Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Public Policy Forum will be taking place on Monday, April 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. at New Haven City Hall. We'll be telling you more about that. It's the first in a series of conversations about some of these issues. Earl, of course, we had planned to have this conversation about the statistics that Ken is going to take us through earlier, and then we saw what happened in South Carolina. I guess I'm just wondering first, before we get into some of this report, if we can talk a little bit about the context of this. What we're all grappling with right now out of that video in South Carolina really deals with what can happen after a traffic stop and what often does happen, sadly, after traffic stops to African-American men and women around America. I guess I'm just wondering the context for you of that video coming out right now as we're having such a serious conversation about racial profiling in our state.
Well, I think, I mean, as we discussed a little bit before the show started, is the context of a traffic stop for an officer is completely different from the context of the traffic stop for many minorities, black and brown people of America. I mean, there have been multiple instances where, I mean, we've seen it on tape, and those instances haven't ended in the death of someone, but someone's been shot. There was an instance about a year and a half ago where a lady had her three kids in the car, and she feared for her life at a traffic stop on the highway, a dark highway. It was an incident caught on tape where a gentleman was stopped by an officer at a gas station, and the officer told him to produce his license. As he went to produce his license, the officer shot him. So the context is very different. What we would like to do with our forums is to have a dialogue and have some solutions. And as the intro that led in, it's not an indictment of every police officer or every police department, but there are some issues that need to be addressed and solutions need to be had.
Ken, as we talk about these statistics now, it is not an indictment of every police officer or every police force in the state, but maybe you can give us the broad overview before we dig into the numbers. I mean, what exactly does your report tell us about racial profiling and police stops in the state?
Sure. So I think the first thing I'd like to say is that this is the most comprehensive report that's been done by any state in the country. And what the report tells us is that there are significant racial and ethnic disparities that exist for minority drivers in the state of Connecticut, both in them being pulled over and also in the post-stop activity. Post-stop activity being vehicle searches and the rate at which illegal contraband is found. And we were able to drill down a little bit deeper in our report and identified 10 municipal police departments and two state police troops where significant racial and ethnic disparities were present.
So overall, the numbers don't look good in the sense that we do see these racial disparities across the board. But you singled out these 10 departments or state police barracks because the numbers are particularly bad.
So we tried to develop a system, and let's just put this in context. 25 other states in the nation collect traffic stop data and analyze that traffic stop data for racial and ethnic disparities. They typically take the traffic stop data and they compare it to a single measure. maybe population data or some sort of a makeup of the drivers on the road. In this report, we took 620,000 traffic stops, broke it down by the department that conducted the traffic stop, and then compared it to seven different measures. We then identified those departments that had consistent, significant disparities based on a majority of those measures.
And so that our listeners understand, one of the reasons Connecticut is able to compile this data, Earl, is some years ago we passed Alvin Penn laws. These had to do with collecting information about racial profiling. He's a late state lawmaker who was himself racially profiled.
Correct.
I know that the African American Affairs Commission originally was tasked with collecting this data, but this has always been a somewhat underfunded organization. Can you just tell us about how it came to be that we got this data and how we've moved forward to the place where we could put together this big report that Ken's talking about?
Okay, so the original report after the Alvin Penn law was passed was done in 2001 and was, I believe, a professor at Central Connecticut State University that did the original reporting, although that reporting, the methodology was different and wasn't as robust as this particular report. It then languished after that report was done for about 4 years. Honestly, nothing was done with it because there was no resources. And then in 2004, the African American Affairs Commission was tasked with then collecting all that data, which Ken can tell you is an inordinate amount of data. Mm-hmm. And also with no staffing and no necessarily financial resources to do so. Not to mention that the collection of the data was just all over the place. Like some departments, there was no methodology. There were some departments were sending in written hand notes, some spreadsheets, some. It was just, like I said, all over the place.
And as we reported some years ago when we talked about this, there were many departments that were not presenting any information at all, despite
correct.
The law that said they had to. You weren't getting that information at all.
That is correct. That is correct. And in 2004. So, again, being ill-equipped to handle that capacity, it languished again for another 7 or 8 years until the law, the Alvin Penn law, was being amended by the state legislature. And the commission then assisted with finding funding, a grant between the Department of Transportation and connecting also with the resources and research of Connecticut Central State University.
We have gone in the state from collecting data from 27 police departments in a variety of different formats to collecting data in a single format electronically from 102 police departments.
Are there any police departments that are not giving you the information that they need to?
There's one police agency that was excluded from this report, and that's the Stanford Police Department. They were having technical difficulties properly collecting and transmitting the data to the state. That has since been corrected, and we anticipate that they will be included in next year's report.
We're talking about a new report compiled by Central Connecticut State University. It has to do with racial profiling and police stops. Ken Barone is here from CCSU, Earl Bloodworth from the African American Affairs Commission, and we're going through some of this. You single out some of the police departments. We've reported already in the air about Groton, Granby, Waterbury, State Police Troops, CNH. I guess I'm wondering, what specifically are we finding about these places? Is it one or two police officers who are making an awful lot of what we might call questionable stops, or what is it we're seeing here, Ken?
So for the three departments and the two state police troops that you just mentioned, there was a statistical method that was applied to their data, and it's called the veil of darkness. And the basic premise behind this methodology is that at 5 o'clock, let's take 5 o'clock in the evening, some parts of the year it's light out, and some parts of the year at 5 p.m. it's dark out. And so you find all the time at the end of the day and at the beginning of the day when it's possible to be light out or dark out. And the basic premise is that an officer is more likely to be able to determine the race or ethnicity of an individual during sunlight hours. And if there was no disparity happening, then you should not see a difference at 5 o'clock in the evening when it's dark out and at 5 o'clock in the evening when it's light out between the rate at which minorities are stopped. And in these five jurisdictions, we found a statistically significant disparity between minority drivers stopped during daylight when compared to darkness after controlling for a variety of seasonal variations.
Earl, when you hear statistics like that, I mean, how do you analyze that? What do you see in that when you when you, because I've never heard of the Veil of Darkness study, and it's a fascinating way to look at this, but it really speaks to one of the major issues here. I mean, how do you analyze this?
I mean, honestly, you'll hear a lot of people say, aha, yeah, this is exactly what we thought. But again, it's not every single police department. It's not every single police officer. And I was at the testimony that was given to the Public Safety Committee yesterday. So they have not actually taken the data yet and drilled down to specific police officers. But we'll be ourselves and the board that advises Connecticut Racial Profiling Project Board will be reaching out to these departments and trying to work with them with different training, as Ken stated in the testimony. They did have some training already of the departments and the new recruits that are coming in to protect and serve the community. So, but it's a large task to deal with people's implicit bias.
And that's the point. It's dealing with people's implicit bias. How do you train against that, Ken?
So the Department of Justice has actually been leading the way in training law enforcement on implicit or unconscious bias. They developed a program a few years ago called Fair and Impartial Policing, and we have actually trained 12 individuals in the state of Connecticut that are certified Department of Justice Fair and Impartial Policing trainers. We'll be holding training for law enforcement supervisors in the coming weeks. And we have also made ourselves available to any police department in the state of Connecticut that would like us to come into their department and train their supervisors and line officers in this one-day fair and impartial policing training. And I should say that that's the beginning of the conversation. It's not a one-day training and we've solved all of our problems. We've developed a system here where we have some departments that we're going to focus on to try and better understand the source of the disparities that exist in their traffic stop data. Community dialogues are a part of the conversation. Fair and impartial policing is a part of the conversation. We have to try and take a holistic approach to how we reduce the likelihood that a minority motorist will be stopped more than they should be in the state of Connecticut.
So we just have a couple minutes left, and I have to ask you both, is there something really surprising in this for either one of you? I mean, an awful lot of people might look at this and say, this is very troubling. Many people, certainly people in minority communities, might say, yeah, of course, this is what's always happened. I mean, I'll ask you first, Earl, and I'd like to get your thoughts, Ken. Are we surprised by any of the numbers we've seen?
Not necessarily surprised by some of the numbers we've seen. We are surprised by some of the places that were and were not listed as outliers. Like, for instance, there was a lot of talk, I guess, a few years ago about Avon being a place that particularly, you know, focused on minorities. And in the reporting, which people can go to on the website and break down the raw data to see for their own particular areas, that, you know, some departments recognize that they had issues and, you know, were proactive, and there have been some that have not. So ourselves, you know, the advisory board for the Racial Profiling Prohibition Advisory Board, the African American Affairs Commission, along with other commissions and the legislature, will try to work with our state, you know, agencies to alleviate this issue. And we're starting that with the forum in New Haven, and we'll be having a series of forums around the state of Connecticut.
Okay.
Hopefully what this report does is it moves the conversation from anecdotes to data. We now are collecting good data, we're analyzing good data, and hopefully the public and law enforcement officials will begin to use data to make what I call data-driven decisions. The context of this conversation around racial profiling in Connecticut and around traffic stops has largely focused on people's personal stories and anecdotes. And although that is useful to be a part of the conversation, we never really had good data to help us make the right decisions and to help us figure out how to address the disparities that exist.
And this is just the beginning. So like Ken said, this is just the start. So we definitely need to have the conversation, have open, honest dialogue, and come up with solutions, not just venting.
Well, exactly. And I just want to say before we run out of time, this panel discussion that you're having, Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Public Forum, happening Monday, April 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. at New Haven City Hall. As you say, Earl, it's one of several conversations like this. And you say this is important to continue to have this conversation, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just a start.
Well, if you want more information about this, you can go to our website, WNPR.org. We'll put up information about this, and we'll make sure we keep you up to date about the other events coming up. Earl Bloodworth from the African American Affairs Commission, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Ken Barone from Central Connecticut State University. Thanks for compiling all this. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about police transparency and arrest records, something else the lawmakers are talking about. We also want to remind you that The Thread, our week-long storytelling series in Hartford, continues tonight with Syllable, the reading series. It's at Hartford Prince at 7 o'clock tonight, featuring our own Julia Pistel. You can go to our Where We Live Facebook page for more information. We'll be right back where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. As you've heard earlier in the show, the General Assembly has been hearing testimony about the prevalence of racial profiling in Connecticut. Lawmakers are considering another bill that would require the disclosure of arrest records. This comes after a state Supreme Court ruling last year that essentially allowed police to withhold information while prosecutions are pending. The shocking new video of a police shooting in South Carolina once again has both of these issues on America's front page. What do we know about whether police pull over African-American drivers at an unacceptably high rate? And what do we know about the details of arrests? And when do we know these details? And that second issue was the center of our conversation last week at Gateway Community College in New Haven, sponsored by the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government. We talked about the specific legislation on access to police records, but also about body cameras on police and trust between citizens and officers that are at the heart of arrest disputes from Ferguson to Staten Island to New Haven. Because we held this conversation last Wednesday in a room filled with students and interested citizens, you won't hear any conversations about the South Carolina shooting, although it obviously hangs over this issue today. Our panelists were Chief State's Attorney Kevin Kane, Assistant Public Defender Tejas Bott, New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman, and Jim Smith, President of the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information. So, Jim, I'd like to start with you. Maybe you can explain what this legislation exactly is. It's passed through a committee right now, and I know it's something that you've been advocating for. Maybe you can explain what it's attempting to do.
Well, I'll try, and please remember that there's different interpretations. Kevin and I have disagreed on a lot of this over the last couple of years, and I think we'll have a spirited discussion. From my point of view, what this bill does is restore the FOI Act to what it had been for 20 years in terms of what the police should release. Since the Supreme Court last summer ruled that the police don't have to release hardly anything. When that decision came down, our state Supreme Court also said that really the legislature needs to take a look at this, and so that's where we are. We have a bill proposed, and it just passed one of the committees to reopen more information that the police have in arrest investigations. And it will wend its way through the legislature, probably go to the Judiciary Committee before it gets to the floor.
So, Kevin Kane, we have heard that you and Jim Smith are on opposite sides of this. What's wrong with this piece of legislation?
Well, as a matter of law or public policy, I think, first of all, the Connecticut Supreme Court last summer had occasion for the first time in many, many years to rule on the scope of the Freedom of Information statute. And they read it the way many of us thought that the legislature intended to do back when they passed the act. I forget how many years have gone by, but during the years, a lot of more information was provided by the public. The commission, the Freedom of Information Commission, allowed more to be made or required more to be released. Then we thought the statute required. The Supreme Court agreed with this, and now they want to undo that. But as a matter of policy, there are a couple of issues involved, and it's complicated and it's not simple. First of all, the police departments, obviously we don't want secret arrests. You can't have secret arrests. The public's entitled to some information. There are some things that go on. There's a conflict that has to be, we have to find the proper balance between. When the police make an arrest based on probable cause to believe somebody committed a crime and a person's charged in court, the investigation really has to continue. There's a difference between probable cause and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. investigations often do not stop at the time of the arrest. People, and we've heard for, and this is what I think brings it to a head, especially today, much more so than years ago, there's a lot of reluctance and hesitation on the part of people to cooperate with the police for a variety of reasons, some of which are understandable. A lot of them are understandable. A lot of people are concerned because they have privacy concerns, mm-hmm. sometimes to reveal information about a crime that's important to us to be able to investigate. You learn about people's private lives in the process. That makes them reluctant to cooperate and reluctant to talk about to discuss things, and they have a right not to talk. And what part of this is while a case is pending, while a case is being prosecuted, we, the state, the prosecutors, and the police need this information to be able to find further facts, to be able to get people to cooperate. The law provides that we have to make information known to the defendants. There's rules, various rules of discovery that the Constitution requires. And we're concerned about the integrity of the investigation, the integrity of the prosecution. Some defense attorneys and defendants are very concerned about their rights to a free trial where a jury, where the whole public doesn't see salacious facts and sensational facts, so much so that now the jury that's supposed to be judge this case based solely on what they hear in the courtroom have their memories so full of sensational things in the news media that it's hard to get a fair and impartial jury.
Tejas Bhatt, now you're sort of in the middle of this, somebody who works as a public defender, and I know that you're a little bit on the fence on some of these things. Give me your take on this particular piece of legislation and what it would do.
You're right, John. I mean, I'm sitting here and thinking, and I'm sort of literally in between these two, and I think metaphorically as well. I wrote down a note that says on one side there's the fair trial, on the other side there's the public trial. I think they're both very important concerns that need to be weighed. On the bill itself, I have to say, I mean, I have some confusion as to what this bill would actually allow police to give out or what would allow media to receive from the bill. And just looking at the basic point is this. I think the more information, the better. I think that the greater exposure there is of the criminal justice system, the way people are arrested, the way people are treated, the better. I think the public needs to be informed of what is going on. I think the last year or two have sort of demonstrated that a lot of the country has a lot of concerns about trust in our police departments, trust in our criminal justice system. And I think the primary way to sort of rebuild some of that is to show what happens, the way it works. So I think, generally speaking, yes. I think I am in support of it. We are in support of this. I do have some concerns that I share with State's Attorney Kane on the limitations of this. How far does it go? How much information should be allowed to be out there? And I think timing is really important. When should the breadth of this information become publicly available? I think one of the things that we are particularly sensitive to is the fact that everybody who reads a newspaper is a potential juror. And everybody who reads a newspaper report about an individual who's accused may get called in to decide the guilt or innocence of that person. And I think newspaper reports that are taken from police blotters are very one-sided. I mean, I think it's sort of a recitation of what the police believes happened, which may or may not be belied by reality. So I think, when is this out? Is it coming out on the eve of trial? Is it coming out in the middle of jury selection? Is it coming out when the jury's deliberating? I think those are all concerns about that need to sort of be taken into account when we're weighing that against the right to have a fair trial, because the right to a fair trial is a critical component of our criminal justice system, that people are not convicted merely because of some sensational thing that they read in the newspaper and formed an opinion without listening to the facts.
Chief Esserman, maybe you can take us through on the ground how some of this works. What you and your officers are charged with reporting, and when, and how legislation like this may or may not affect the work that you do.
It's interesting. I find myself understanding both sides of this argument, and not feeling very defensive at all. I'm a lawyer. I was a prosecutor in New York before I became a police chief, and I've been a police chief a long time. And I think it's really a question of trust. when it comes to a trial, everyone needs to be respected and protected. To say that I can ignore the privacy of a victim because it's good public policy is not to live with victims. And I don't have the luxury of ignoring that by any means. At the same time, to say just trust me because I have a badge is really not enough. So I'm very comfortable releasing information when it's safe for everybody. And I'm very conscious of the fact that people are often very skeptical of the profession that I love. But we take an oath as significant and as serious as that of a judge or a priest or a doctor. We believe in honoring our oath. One of the things most remarkable about a police officer is the compassion they have for victims. It's very hard to tell a victim, we're going to tell everybody everything you told us. And we're going to tell you now because it's good public policy for America. Because I've had many a victim say, but what about me? And what about my family? And I think I hear more agreement than disagreement about the importance of transparency. I think the question for me is one of timing. When it comes to a trial, lives are at stake. The life and freedom of the accused, and please be clear, the life and freedom of many who must bear witness. And to be deaf and blind to one side is as foolish as being deaf and blind to the other.
I have to ask you, because I feel like we have the idea of trust coming across in two different ways. Both you and Tejas talked about the idea that, especially right now in America, there may perhaps, Chief Esserman, be a lack of trust in urban police departments, at least in some quarters. And that's something you want to build over time, right? Well, but at the same time Kevin Kane is saying, there's also there's a trust with individuals. You want to make sure that you safeguard the individual trust of a person who feels like they don't necessarily want their information going out there to the public right away. So I get that it is public policy on one hand and it's individuals on the other hand, but they both have to do, don't they, with building trust in police forces.
I couldn't agree with you more. First off, this is not about urban police departments. If you think Ferguson was an urban police department, you're wrong. It's a police department of 50 officers. This is about American police departments. And trust is at stake. You know, this uniform, which I'm proud to wear every day, is a great source of pride for me. The chief doesn't have to wear the uniform. I wear it by choice because I'm proud to wear it every day. But it has taken me a lifetime to truly understand that the uniform I wear with great pride, for many others, is a source of pain or distrust. And I've come to understand that. So how do you build trust? Well, I think there's really only one way to build trust, because legitimacy no longer just comes from the badge of office, whether it's a court office, prosecutor's office, or police office. It comes from the person in that uniform or in that authority building relationships. And that is what we're most profoundly doing here in New Haven. Community policing is a word that has come into the vernacular in my lifetime. I've spent my career implementing it in cities like my beloved New Haven. But more than anything, community policing is breaking through the barrier of the uniform.
That's New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman, with Chief State's Attorney Kevin Kane, Assistant Public Defender Tejas Bhatt, and Jim Smith, the President of the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information. We're listening back to a panel about police transparency we taped last week in New Haven. More to come after this break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, live music in our Studio 3 with the Roots Trio, Last Fair Deal. Paul Howard, Tom Hagmassey, and Phil Zimmerman have been playing bluegrass and music just like it for the past 40 years. They'll be visiting with us and playing some of their music. Hope you can join us. The Connecticut General Assembly is considering a bill that would require the disclosure of arrest records. This comes after a state Supreme Court ruling last year that allowed police to withhold information while prosecutions are pending. This issue has pitted police against freedom of information advocates and has raised a lot of concerns about protections for victims of crime. We're listening back to a conversation on this issue that we taped last week. It was sponsored by the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government. It was in New Haven at Gateway Community College. Our panelists were New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman, Chief State's Attorney Kevin Kane, Assistant Public Defender Tejas Bhatt, and Jim Smith, President of the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information. If the goal is to make it so we have transparent police departments in our communities, is there some middle ground there that we can meet? Here's Jim Smith.
We're going to reach a compromise. Here's some guidance from the state Supreme Court, which ruled that all the police have to release is the name of the person arrested, the date, the place, and some written document that could be nothing more than the name, rank, and serial number. That's all. But in making that decision, Justice Robinson wrote this, and this is from the decision, okay? The same interest might extend to information showing that an arrestee is an undocumented alien, or that individuals were exercising rights of free speech or assembly when arrested, or that an arrestee had an extensive criminal history, or is in a position of public trust, or how a killer obtained weapons. All of that information that Justice Robinson just listed, the police don't have to release anymore. Unless the bill before the legislature gets passed. The law in effect right now is way too restrictive for a democracy to operate correctly.
Is there some of that, Kevin Kane, that can be rolled back that would sensibly allow us to know some of the information that Jim and others want to know that doesn't jeopardize your work or doesn't jeopardize Dean Esserman's work?
I think there is, and I think the legislature could provide when somebody's arrested right now, the booking information, basic name, address, time of arrest, crimes with which the person is charged has to be released. I think we could expand on that, and the statute right now provides that. In addition to that, the police have to make release either what's been interpreted as a full investigative reports of the case, which could be a long 6 months, year long, who knows how long investigation, including any other documents or records made by the police, which under that interpretation would include photographs, crime scene photographs, booking shots, bodies of victims, other things, photographs of that, all sorts of information. In lieu of that, if the police could release a summary setting forth the facts on which the police based their conclusion that there was probable cause to make an arrest, if they could set forth as police have to do all of the time to support an arrest, to submit an affidavit to the court or to a judge, which would support the issuance of an arrest warrant, facts and circumstances setting forth the probable cause, I think that would be a fair compromise at that point, to have the police release that. Otherwise, what happens here? Let's say how many people are arrested now on charges that can have an interesting note to what happened. For some reason inspires as what a dumb thing to do or how could, you know, a foolish thing. It ends up getting somebody arrested. Right now, you can look at any newspaper around or any on the media and see who was arrested in your town. There'll be mugshots there of people who don't look very good because they've just been arrested. They may have had too much to drink. They may have done who knows what, and their mugshot certainly is not something inspiring. And go look in that website, and you find detailed facts about what they were arrested for. Short time later, the charges are dismissed. They get a program, the case gets nollied, or even if they're convicted, the case gets dismissed because they've applied for a program. They're told by the court, once your case is dismissed, your record is erased completely. If you're asked, you can tell, you can say you've never been arrested. They apply for a job. I've never been arrested. The employer checks the court records, the police records. They're erased. There's no record. But then they Google them. And what do they find? Not only is mugshot, the story about the facts and circumstances for which he was arrested, and we're expecting, we're hoping that employers will hire these people. But what kind of negative impact does that have?
So, Tejas, you represent these poor unfortunates, the people who end up in these mugshots that they probably don't want to. What's your take on what you're hearing?
Yeah, and I think that's the one concern that we have with the problem that I have is this, and I don't know if it's a problem of the way that our society is set up now, that we're sort of very sensationalist and we love to hear these stories. But the problem that I have is exactly that there is no attendant responsibility that comes along with publishing the report of the arrest and the salacious details of the arrest, that there is no responsibility that comes with it for that news organization to update that story. The reason why I think there is hesitation from some parties to have unfettered disclosure is that there is no way to take it back if it needs to be taken back. And I think that impacts people's lives. So there has to, I mean, it has to be done in a measured way. I mean, I can give you an example that happened in New Haven 2 months ago. There was a trial, and there was a trial for a murder. And before the trial started, there was a suppression hearing in which the judge suppressed the alleged confession because the judge found that the defendant had been coerced and threatened and pressured into giving that confession. So it gets suppressed, and the jury acquits the defendant of the murder. The New Haven Register was aware of the confession, runs a story the day after, and now jurors are calling up saying, wait a minute, you hoodwinked us, and this guy's actually guilty, and the court lied to us. And I think the reporter did a wonderful job of explaining why it was suppressed, but I think the implications there are, what if that had come out before the verdict? What if that had been known at some point without context? Would a person who should have been acquitted then suddenly even been found guilty? And I think there's a responsibility there that I think we're concerned about. And I'm not necessarily saying that you know, none of this information should be out there. As I started at the outset saying, it should be out there. We're all for open, for transparency. But I think there are implications beyond just make all the information available that do need to be taken into account.
Well, Jimmy,
what you just described was malfeasance in the court system. You know, and so the press shouldn't write about that. I mean, here's an innocent man found guilty, and nobody knows. That's just a miscarriage of justice. All this talk about erasing history is a very scary thing. You know, that's what the Soviet Union used to do. It used to, you know, the pictures of Khrushchev and all the people around him, they'd airbrush guys out because they don't exist anymore. We can't go around erasing history. If you were arrested, you were arrested. And if you were found innocent, you were found innocent. Or if you're found guilty, you're found guilty. It all happened. You can't just make it go away.
Chief Esserman, I mean, something that you just happened in your city, and it's happened over and over again across America. And I think we know that this is another part of the new world, too. Not only does information live forever on Google, but you don't have to be arrested necessarily to be caught on camera, whether you're a police officer or whether you're a private citizen doing something stupid or illegal. And this, you know, happened recently in your city. There was a video of an officer and a scuffle with a young woman during a St. Patrick's Day parade, and there's been some protests around it, and there's been some controversy around this piece of video. This is really about an image that gets out there. It's not about an arrest. It's about an image. And does that change anything about the discussion that we're having? Because the bar seems to be quite a bit different. Because even just an image, a video of something, can then live on forever and cause its own narrative.
I'm a lover of the Constitution, and I was taught in law school that the Constitution is a living document, and that's why there are amendments, because the law continually changes and evolves and is interpreted for the times we live in. But I think our base values stay the same. You know, we take an oath to enforce the law. We're not a king's army. We're not a Praetorian guard. We're not a believer that anyone is above the law, including ourselves. So do I think Connecticut can be seen as a place where compromise is valued instead of going to the barricades and assaulting each other with words? I hope so, because I'm proud to be a New Havener. I'm proud to be a Connecticut person. You know, this is one of the oldest police departments in America, New Haven, one of the great old cities of America, built on the values of our country and our Constitution. But times change. This is an age of no privacy. This is an age of transparency. On the day you spoke about St. Patrick's Day 2 weeks ago, that officer would have loved to have had a video camera on his body. Most officers believe in body cameras. Most unions believe in body cameras. Most police chiefs believe in body cameras. More often than not, it's become a time where when we're at the scene, we're the only one without a camera. And we would welcome a camera. We've been working for almost 2 years with our union, hand in hand, to figure out how to bring cameras to New Haven. We're not fighting it. The union's not fighting it. It's an enlightened conversation about not rushing fast, but doing it together and doing it well.
If we end up, Kevin Kane, with all the police officers in New Haven and the other cities and towns, maybe in Connecticut, with wearing body cameras, what should our expectation in the press be as far as getting access to those videos of those arrests?
Well, under the laws, Jim Smith would like to have it, propose it. Immediately upon the arrest, all that information would be would have to be released to the public by the police.
So, and that's a good thing, right?
Well, maybe not. There is information now, and here's one of the problems. On an issue like that, you get different groups that are very interested, some for good reason, in finding out the facts and trying to investigate. The obligation of the police, first of all, is to investigate and determine the facts and what happened, be able to interview witnesses who haven't been interviewed. It's important, I think, to let the police be able to investigate, maintain the integrity of that investigation. Then when it's complete, and let the public know at the right time all of that.
The question that, of course, that many of us in the press had, for instance, after the Sandy Hook shooting, is what should the length of the investigation be? I mean, at what point is too long to have the investigation go before we have access to the documents that we would need to access in order to make our own determination about the work that was done?
A full year was too long. You know, the state's attorney took a year to release information on that horrific event. And he finally had to release it under the Freedom of Information Act, which the Supreme Court just struck down. There has been a pull and tug, a healthy pull and tug, between fair trial and free press. The citizens of America were granted a fair and public trial, not a secret trial, a public trial, right? And the citizens of the United States were also granted freedom of the press, which the job of the press is to monitor the government and see that it's doing it right. Whether the government is the president of the United States, the mayor of your town, or the judge at the trial, the duty of the press is to keep the government honest. Is there a tug and pull between fair trial and free press? There always is, but the answer is not to suppress reports of crime and punishment in America.
Tejas, do you have a last thought?
I do, and I think I'm with you, Jim, but would that were it so. I think that the right to a public trial and the right to a fair trial are critical in our system. I agree with Ken's comment about how it is important to have an impartial jury, because that is the very foundation of our system, where people can get a fair trial. I think if you look at jurisprudence that has talked about cases that there's publicity, we're talking the last 50 years, we're talking the last 20 years, we're talking about Skilling, which happened in 2011. And I think that where we part ways is if the press were that what you described, the examiner of government abuse and overreach, and if they were the microscope through which we look at the abuses and misconduct, I think it is an absolutely valuable tool, and they should be, the press should be given as much leeway as possible. But I think the reality is that it is not. I mean, I think the reality is that you are in the smoking gun age. You are in the mugshot age, where it's all about getting that picture, getting clicks to your website with sensationalist headlines and nothing more. And I think that is where we part ways, and that's what harms the right to a fair trial.
Kevin Kane, a last thought from you?
You know, witnesses or defendants or people who've been arrested are free to go out and tell the world what happened, what they saw, what they observe, how they feel about it, who's right or who's wrong. Any witness, any defendant, anybody can go out. One of the concerns we have is a lot of times people will talk to the police because they realize it's important to get to the truth. The public has an interest in having a crime solved correctly and accurately. And they'll be free to talk to the police. They'll do so. But they'll have some trust in police officers not subjecting them to embarrassment or harassment by friends or cajolery or whatever by their fellow workers or friends and neighbors unless it's very important to do. And they'll recognize they recognize that they may have to testify at a trial. They may have to come up and testify in public in a trial, because trials are public. Anybody can go into the courtroom. We have cameras in the courtroom. I would have said, unfortunately, long ago, and in a way still do, but they're there, and that's a reality. There are cameras in the courtroom, and they know that. But they at least should have the comfort that we, and they know they may be embarrassed as a result. They may have private details about their lives, about their relationships with somebody come out that they'd rather not have. But they recognize that if it comes to that, it's important.
But you understand that from the press's standpoint, that the idea that we should only get information from those who choose to talk is sort of the opposite of what we're trying to do. I mean, the story told only by those who want to tell their story is not necessarily an objective truth that we're trying to get to.
And we have the exact same problem. We don't have a grand jury system, the state, where we can subpoena people, and we debated a little bit of that today, and give them immunity and have them testify. People, just like the press, people want to talk to you. If people talk to you, they want to have some confidence that they'll use what they tell you in confidence and you won't unduly embarrass them. We're on the other side of the exact same coin. People will tell us things with the understanding that we won't unduly embarrass them or subject them to embarrassment.
Chief Esserman, I'll give you the last word, and you're in the front lines of this. I'm wondering what you'd like us to take away.
You know, I'm not sure I have more to add. I think that, like most American police chiefs, I respect the argument. I'm glad I was here tonight to hear it, to reinforce it. But what I heard here tonight was a spirit of compromise, that we heard each other, which is something we need to do more in this country. Be able to listen hard and hear the concerns that each other has about issues that are sacred to us as a constitutional democracy. So I'm listening.
That's New Haven Police Chief Dean Esserman, Chief State's Attorney Kevin Kane, Assistant Public Defender Tejas Bhatt, and Jim Smith, President of the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information. This panel was taped last week at Gateway Community College in New Haven, and it was sponsored by the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government. It was produced by our executive producer, Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Lori Mack for help with production. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.